First of all, I want to say it's been a real honor to be with you. And I want to thank you so much for your practice. It's been beautiful. You've been really quiet and deep and a lot of samadhi. And it's been especially an honor to be in on interviews with James. I liked hearing the way he teaches and that he pulls out the wisdom that's already in each one of the people that go to interview him. So it was lovely to watch that process and just watch you become more open and more trusting of who you are. And I also want to say it was real honor to teach with Sari and Anne. That's what I said.
That's what I said.
Close.
Thank you. Okay. You can tell my Finnish is not good. Anyway, it was a pleasure and honor to teach with both of you. And I wanted to give all of you some tips for how to practice, take your practice into the world. Because I also learned a lot from doing individual interviews with people. That was really enriching for me. And one of the tips is to pick a consistent time of day. And probably many of you already have a daily practice. Is that right? Raise your hand if you already have a daily practice. Most people here do. But sometimes it lapses, you know. We leave retreat and we go, yeah. And then after a while, it kind of gets harder and harder. So one of the things is to really make it consistent, like you probably do with your flossing of your teeth. After you, you know, you do that at a certain time of day. It's the same kind of thing. Just pick a consistent time, possibly in an attractive, pleasant place, and maybe connect it with another habit you do, like your yoga or whatever. And for people who have trouble maintaining the amount of time, pick a bite-sized practice, maybe 20 minutes, maybe 20 minutes in the morning, and then if it's really going well, do 20 minutes in the evening. But if you can do something that you feel good about, then it's easier to add on than to say, oh, I'm going to do an hour and a half every day, and by the third day you feel like a failure. So, and when you accomplish something, like just at the end of your sitting, perhaps say a little thank you to yourself, even though your sitting might not be as clear as it was here. You know, probably when you go back into your busy life, there'll be much more wandering mind. But if since you know that, and that happens to me, it happens to all of us, since you know that, don't judge your mind when you go back and say, oh, I've lost it. Instead, just say, wow, okay, I'm still sitting. My mind wandered 50 times, and I brought it back 49 times. So hopefully with the tips that James gave us, being kind and relaxed and interested, bringing your mind back to the moment over and over, it's just a really good mental muscle to keep building. And as Anne said so beautifully, practice in community. So start a group and find a sitting group, connect with other like-minded people. When you go back, there'll be friends and relatives that know nothing about this. And basically, when I would suggest, when they ask you how it was, just tell them something like, oh, it was great. Unless it wasn't great, then you could say, oh, it was was interesting. And just leave it at that. Because all they really want to know is that you're okay. And you can tell your more heartfelt responses to the people that are in the community that would understand a little easier. There's a lot of guided meditations, which you know, on Naroda and Dharma Seed and Insight Timer. And for those that are interested in the mindful self-compassion, you can Google mindful self-compassion. There's a lot of free guided meditations that might be helpful to you. And then just make your life your practice, you know. If possible, create a little more space in your life so that you can practice, so that you can come from a more mindful place. We all live really busy lives, or most of us. And so look and see how you can slow down a little bit, even if it's walking from one building to another, or walking from the tram to your office, or whatever. Just look for little pockets in your day where you can just slow down, maybe do some mindful walking. I used to, as a teacher, do mindful walking from the office to my classroom. Just that was my time. And then it turned into kind of a metta mudita practice, because I'd walk down the halls and I'd see a lot of former students, and it was fun to say hello to them. So, but being mindful, that's the thing. Figure out other times outside, off the cushion, when you can connect with people and connect with yourself and really be mindful. And so when you're in a moment of confusion, I would say just stop and ask yourself, what's going to help me deepen? What will help me really? And listen to your own inner wisdom. The question is not, am I good enough? Once I was on retreat, and this was a retreat, a 3-month retreat, so there were a lot of very dedicated, sincere practitioners, and one of the Dharma teachers asked, how many of you wonder if you're good enough? And everybody but one person put up their hand. So that is a question deep down, I think, that we all have. Am I good enough? And I'm suggesting that that's the wrong question. The question is, what's good for me? And I don't mean in a small, selfish way. I mean, what will really nourish me? What will help me be kinder and wiser? So I really suggest that you turn that around. And I want to close with some suggestions with Bob Sharples. He's an Australian meditation teacher. He's also was an attorney, a lawyer, and he's a father of many kids, and he's a meditation teacher. And he says, use meditation as an act of love. Don't meditate to fix yourself, to heal yourself, to improve yourself, to redeem yourself. Rather, do it as an act of love, of deep, warm friendship to yourself. In this way, there is no longer any need for the subtle aggression of self-improvement, for the endless guilt of not doing enough. It offers the possibility of an end to the ceaseless round of trying so hard that wraps so many people's lives in a knot. Instead, there is now meditation as an act of love. How endlessly delightful and encouraging. So let's just sit for a moment and just take that in.
Turn. First, I wanted to start off with a contemporary prayer. I don't think I read this here. You might have all kinds of ideas of how you're going to bring your practice into your life, and you got it figured out. But it can be humbling sometimes. So here's a prayer. Dear God, so far today I've done okay. I haven't gossiped or lost my temper. I haven't been crabby, mean, nasty, selfish, bitchy, or overindulgent. And I'm very grateful for that. But dear God, in a few minutes I'm going to get out of bed. And then I'm going to need a lot more help. Amen. It's one thing to know it all in here, and it's a whole other to live it and more embody it. And we're on a process of more and more embodying what we've been touched by, what we know to be true, and more and more moving from the concept to the manifestation. Ajahn Chah has a great teaching. I mentioned him before. He says there's first you hear the Dharma, and then you practice the Dharma, and then you understand or realize the Dharma, and then you become the Dharma. It's a wonderful book called Being Dharma, where you're hearing things over and over, and little by little they sink in, and it's not just some distant memory or idea, but it's a lived understanding, and that's when your practice is deepening and maturing from verified faith, and people can feel it. They'll be feeling it from you right now anyway, but more and more this is a process of patience and just repetition and deepening your understanding. So first, a couple of things to keep in mind as you're leaving. Maybe you saw how sensitive you are. Did you notice that when you started talking? Like I said early this morning, you're like a newborn baby. And just like a baby, there will be energy swings where you have a lot of energy, wow, intense, and then you might crash. Particularly these next few days. Often we give ourselves as long as we were sitting to go through the second part of the practice, the re-entry, the return. And along with, if there's energy swings, there's also likely to be mood swings, which can be very humbling when you think, you know, hey, I've gotten centered. You know, what's going on here? Or what was I, who was I kidding? if you go through those mood swings, be very gentle with yourself. The next few days, even more than the mindfulness part, remember the kindness and the non-judging this next week. And then for the rest of your life. And you might, those people, those close to you, you might enroll them, even if they don't understand what you've been through. Just say, I'm a little bit more sensitive. Please, I hope you can be patient with me. And if you need to take some time to just regroup, and because the stimulation is a bit overwhelming, that's fine. Really take care of yourself so that you can then be with others. You're learning more and more, and the wisdom that you've touched, yeah, it's not going to be the same when you go back. There's not the conditions as far as the quiet, as far as the connection, as far as the spaciousness. But what you've touched is in there. And then it's more and more a matter of just knowing and remembering, creating the conditions for you to access it. As Jane said, a daily sitting practice is hugely important. When I first learned this meditation, and I told you how inspired I was, how excited, wow! And I had the thought, but do I really have to do the meditation part? And I found that, yeah, you do, because it's so easy to get lost. And so my just echoing and tagging on my own personal agreement with myself, you know, Jane said very wisely, it's good to find a time and a place, and maybe you have a sacred area where you can light a candle or have some pictures that inspire you. But short of that, my agreement with myself is I will get into the posture every day. That's the least that I am committed to do. And I usually sit in the morning. Jane and I often sit together in the morning. And it's great to do with a partner, by the way. Cuts through all the drama and all of who's right and who's wrong, just in that silence. Oh, yes. Hi. and often in the evening, especially if I'm teaching. But sometimes I'll be out the door. It's a very busy day, full day with lots of commitments or meetings or whatever. I'll always ask myself before I go to sleep, before my head hits the pillow, have I meditated today? And if the answer is no, I'll just get right up in bed, or I'll go into the living room for a few minutes. It's getting into the posture that's the hard part. I've been doing this for many years, and I can't remember having meditated and then saying, oh, I shouldn't have done that. Once you're there, it's, oh, yes. Oh, it's so nice to connect with this being in here. The only problem that you'd say, oh, maybe I shouldn't have done that, is if you judge your sittings. Don't do that. You just put in your time and know that you are honoring the Dharma when you get into that posture, and you're just letting go of the day's accumulations. The sittings will, sometimes they might be relatively clear, sometimes they might be all over the map. Doesn't matter. You just show up, and there's something about that reconnection that's very powerful. And as you more and more get in touch, it's like you're creating the conditions. You'll remember a precious moment that you touched on retreat. As I mentioned before, you know, not to give you those moments away, but not to forget them either. And so if there was one moment that really spoke to you or that really moved you, remember that. Because that's just opening up to that channel that you know is true. And I want to share with you an email from someone who has been practicing for a number of years, and she's been doing a lot of longer retreats, and she really was hard on herself for some time, and in recent times just really turned the corner and really is seeing, oh, I have all this wisdom inside of me. How wonderful. And she wrote me this letter, this email. Oh, if I can get it.
No.
I lost the connection to it. Well, she says something like this. Do you know that? Oh no, it's a difficult. I've got to print out this letter. And she says, this is what she said, basically. She wrote a letter to herself, her future self, that said something like this. Dear future self, that self that gets confused and discouraged and judging and lost, I want you to remember this. Don't think that you don't know what's true. It's all in there. And what you are remembering, it's really true. And this path is really worth it. And you're doing great. And I love you. And I'm so grateful that you're putting in this time and this sincerity. And even though it might seem like you're lost, you just keep going. There's only one direction this is going. You're doing just great. Remember that. I was so moved. She says it in a much more beautiful way than I can recreate now. But there's something in you that knows, and don't discount that or feel that, that was then, and I have to go on another retreat and maybe I'll be okay again. It's right inside. And when you get lost, if you just quiet down enough so that you move out of this chatter in the mind and the finger that's wagging at you saying, you better not blow it. Don't believe that. There's a place in you, a deeper place that knows. And this is, I haven't forgotten that I'd say a couple of things about the last two steps in Awakening Joy. I haven't forgotten. And one of them is the last step is called the joy of simply being, where instead of trying to figure things out, where you just stop the trying and listen and relax like that. As I gave that image of going from flailing to floating. And if you can listen inside, all the wisdom is there, in there. There's an image that illustrates this, the Tibetan figure Milarepa. If you are familiar with the Tibetan Tonkas and the great masters, Milarepa, who was like the ultimate great yogi. He spent years in a cave and meditating. And you can always tell it's Milarepa in the Tanka because he has his hand to his ear and he's listening to the song of the Dharma, which is right inside. And this is what we're learning to do. When you stop trying to figure out and you just open up and trust in the awareness, that the awareness can meet the moment. The wisdom is right in there. And more, the practice is one of really learning to listen. And that means going from this mind, this head that's trying to figure everything out, to a deeper place of connection. I'll share with you, I'll give you a little transmission on this, that Ram Dass, who I mentioned before, one of my two main teachers, gave me a few years ago. I mentioned it, I think, in one of the groups. A couple of years ago, Jane and I were visiting him in Hawaii, and there was this one issue that I wanted his take on, because I wanted him to confirm my point of view. Yeah, there's this, you know, and what do you think? And he stopped for a moment. He had a stroke about 22 years ago, so he doesn't speak as brilliantly and fluently as he used to. But every word counts. And he said, you know, it's really very simple. Instead of thinking about the right answer, it's all about making the journey from here to here. And when he said it, it just was so obvious. Oh, I'm in my head trying to solve and be right or prove the right thing or whatever. And when I come down to here in my heart, all the answers are become clear. And that's been a great teaching for me. This is really the essence of this joy of simply being and trusting and being able to listen and just opening up to let life reveal itself. So first, I invite you to do this with me so your body remembers. Hear all the thoughts, all trying to figure it out. Who's right? Who's wrong? What should I do? And now come down to here. The place that knows, what Ajahn Chah used to say, your Buddha knowing. Once again, from here, go down to here. Third time is the charm. Here, to just listen to the truth and the wisdom inside, down to here. Trust that. Quiet down enough to hear it. And get all the support that you can to create the conditions that help you to remember what you already know. When you hear somebody say something wise, don't get fooled into thinking, oh, they're so wise. Gee, maybe I'll be wise like that someday. No. They're saying something that touches a place in you that says, yep, right on, that's the truth. And this is what we're really learning, is to get in touch with the Buddha right inside, like we did at the very beginning of the retreat. I take refuge in the Buddha. I take refuge in that Buddha that's right inside, that knows, that loves the truth, that wants to wake up, and that has the seeds of wisdom already here. And this is a process, like I say, little by little you're practicing more and more. And I just want to explain to you an image that shows how this process works. Joseph Goldstein, my teacher, used to use this analogy. I don't know if he still does, but it's always been helpful for me. Just imagine there's a hill, a steep hill, and you're trying to get a ball to stay right in the center in the top of that hill. It's not so easy. It's very easy for that ball to just slip off. because the center is not very stable. That's like the beginning of practice, where maybe every now and then you get a glimpse of the truth. And it's powerful, and you know it, but it's so easy to forget. As you keep on practicing, that hill becomes flat, and that ball is in the center, and it stays there more regularly. It can still be blown off with a gust of wind, but not as easily. That's as you keep on practicing, you get more stable and level and grounded. And as you keep on deepening your practice, that hill and that ground becomes a valley. And that ball is in the center, and that's where it mainly lives. And even though the gust of wind can blow it off, this is where it naturally comes back to. That's deepening your practice. And that's what you're doing. So every moment of mindfulness counts, and every retreat that you do, and every time you're deepening your practice, it's all deepening that connection to home. It was Anna mentioned about retreats. Each time you learn something new. Not that it's only about retreats, because what you do on retreats informs the way you live your life, and what you do in your life informs your retreat practice. And so there's an internal development and then an external expression of it. But don't think if you've done a retreat, you know, that, I think I know what retreating is about. The first time I did a long retreat, my parents, I was in my 20s, and my parents were afraid that I joined some kind of a cult, you know. What is he getting into? 3 months of silence, what's going on there? But I came back, and they saw, oh, something good has happened. All right, maybe it's okay. But the second time I told them I was going, they said, didn't you get it the last time? And it was hard to explain, but I just had to, because it was so compelling and I was learning so much about what it means to be human. And so if you're drawn to do this more and more, listen to that. Not because, oh, I'll be a good spiritual person if I do, but just because there's something that's calling you, and know that that's part of the deal. It's not the full deal, but it deepens and opens you up to how you can be in the world in a wise, caring, compassionate way. And this leads me to that last wholesome state in awakening joy. And as I said, that these are the Buddha's teachings that I found helpful, to just see that these can all be practiced. So don't think, oh, this is James' ideas. This is the Buddha's, and they work, and they can all be practiced. And one essential understanding is that you're not just practicing for your own well-being. What you do affects everyone around you. And that was why the Buddha was motivated to teach after he became enlightened. I think I said, did I tell you, after he was enlightened, he said, I don't know if I want to do it. And then he saw, oh, other people can understand this, and spent the last 45 years out of compassion teaching what he discovered. And compassion is the full flowering of an awakened heart. And particularly these days, the world needs as much consciousness as it can get. There's so much suffering in the world. As one of my good friends and wise friends says, we're in a race between fear and consciousness. And consciousness ultimately wins out over fear. But we're in a race because there's a lot, there's not that much time as far as the direction of humans on this planet, and there's not been an era where man, where humans can actually affect the lives of everyone on this planet, and there's the capacity for self-destruction as there's never been. And it's scary at times. But there's never been as much consciousness as there is right now on this planet. Never. These teachings that had been esoteric are now available online for everyone. And there is this movement of caring that, as often happens, the shadow brings out the light. The light brings out the shadow, and the shadow brings out the light. And we are all agents of consciousness. And what you do matters not just for yourself, but for all of us. And there's a kind of rippling effect. Just like you've probably been touched by a friend who got into this, or something that you read, or a Dharma talk that you've heard, it ripples out, and it ripples from whoever received it from their teachers, through them, through you, and just gets passed on through you as well. So this wholesome state of compassion is something that not only can be cultivated, but is necessary for the cultivation, for the well-being of all. And I want to read to you, if I can find it, a passage from Bhikkhu Bodhi, who is the most respected translator of the Buddhist teachings. If you see all of these thick collections of discourses, the middle-length discourses or the connected discourses, thick, thick volumes, that's Bhikkhu Bodhi that's translated all of them. He's really got a clear, deeply scholarly mind. And he also, in the last 10 or 15 years, has seen that this practice is about making a difference in the world. And he's founded something called Buddhist Global Relief that has raised lots of money for hunger relief and education of young women in underserved countries. And he wrote an essay called A Challenge to Buddhists. And I want to read to you a little excerpt from this, just so you see your practice in a bigger context. He says, if Buddhism in the West becomes solely a means to pursue personal spiritual growth, I'm apprehensive, I'm concerned, that it may evolve in a one-sided way and thus fulfill only half of its potential, attracting the rich and the educated. It will provide a congenial, comfortable home for the intellectual and cultural elite. But it will risk turning the quest for enlightenment into a private journey that, in the face of the immense suffering which daily hounds countless human lives, can present only a resigned quietism. the special challenge facing Buddhism, facing the Dharma in our age, is to stand up as an advocate for justice in the world, a voice of conscience for those victims of social, economic, and political injustice who cannot stand up and speak for themselves. And that includes this planet that needs our voices. And Bhikkhu Bodhi, since this, has become a very major voice for planetary, environmental consciousness in the face of climate change. This, in my view, is a deeply moral challenge marking a watershed in the modern expression of Buddha Dharma. I believe it points in the direction that Buddhism should take if it is to share in the Buddha's ongoing mission to humanity. So to see your practice in this context, where what you do as you deepen your understanding and your truth matters not only for your own well-being, but becomes an offering and a gift to the world, that just ups the inspiration tremendously. And I want to read to you one last passage in case you're saying, who, me? I don't know if I can do this. This is called, this is a passage on commitment. This is by W.H. Murray, who wrote the Scottish Himalayan Expedition. Until one is committed, there's hesitancy, the chance to draw back, always ineffectiveness. Concerning all acts of initiative and creation, there's one elementary truth, the ignorance of which kills countless ideas and splendid plans. And that is that the moment one definitely commits oneself, then providence, God, or life, or all good in the world, then providence moves too, once you commit yourself. All sorts of things occur to help one that would never otherwise have occurred. A whole stream of events issues from that decision, raising in one's favor all manner of unforeseen incidents and meetings and material assistance which no person could have dreamt would have come their way. I've learned a deep respect for one of Goethe's couplets, "Whatever you can do or dream you can, begin it." Boldness has genius, power, and magic in it. Just what you need inside of you. And the more you can help awaken it, the more everyone benefits. So I am cheering you on. We're all cheering you on. And know that everyone here can make a difference in the world. And I just want to say what a privilege and honor and joy to to practice with you and see your sincerity and your courage and your good hearts and I just thank you for what you've done here this week and for your continued practice. And also want to thank Anna for all you've done this week and in this community. And sorry for all that you contribute for all of these years and these years of friendship. For Melissa and Tuliki and Aki and Sally, there you are back there, and all the Donna, the energetic Donna, your work periods, you know, I see. Wow, I said to Melissa, they really use an hour and a half for work. She said, oh yeah, they're really working. And what a joy to see such generous hearts. And it's just such a joy to be here. And we all get to share this Dharma field together. Isn't it wonderful? Now we get to take it out into the world. So, look forward to seeing you around the Dharma Trail, and we have our dates for next year already. July. July 8th through 15th or something like that. Hope to see you next year too. Okay. Enough. Mm.